It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to a UW-Madison economist about what makes a good business climate and how that idea has shifted over time. First, House Republicans voted last week to remove Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney from her position as their conference chair. That move was in response to Cheney's criticism of former President Donald Trump and his false claims about fraud during the 2020 election. Here's a listen to Cheney talking with reporters just after that vote on Wednesday.
I think that it is an indication of where the Republican Party is, and I think that the party is in a place that we've got to bring it back from, and we've got to get back to a position where we are a party that can fight for conservative principles, that can fight for substance. We cannot be dragged backward by the very dangerous lies of a former president.
Other Republicans, including House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, say President Trump will continue to be a leading voice in the Republican Party. You're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of House Republicans removing Liz Cheney from her leadership post? If you tend to vote Republican, do you think the party should keep itself close to Trump or move in a new direction? Does your vote depend on what direction that ends up being? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Our guest for this conversation is Tim Hagel. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Let's start with this conference chair position that Cheney held in Congress. It isn't really familiar in households necessarily as far as political jobs go. Give us a sense of what the conference chair does and how significant it is to be removed from that spot.
Well, as far as some of the details, I suppose one minor detail is that the conference chair supposedly chairs the meetings when the conference, meaning all the Republican members of the House, get together for one of their meetings. And so in that sense, it's kind of a procedural type of position. But more generally, as one of the top leadership positions for, in this case, Republicans, and this would be true for, you know, Democrat leadership too, is that you want to have people that are can talk to the other members, but also talk to the media and talk to constituents, that you're sort of a much more visible kind of position there. And that gives you more responsibility for communicating the message that the GOP Republican Party wants to convey.
Put this into context for us, then. How important is it, or how often does it happen that someone is removed from that place as opposed to stepping down?
Well, it's probably going to be more likely the stepping down thing, where if the conference for some reason loses faith in somebody, or maybe the person has, if not a personal scandal, some sort of problem with the media, that something comes out, that something happened, and it kind of is embarrassing to the party, the person would probably step down. In this case, Cheney decided not to do that, and so it forced the Republicans' hand to vote her out, which became very visible. And of course, the media picked up on that, and you saw a lot of people pushing this, say, oh, well, look, this is, you know, a break, a dissension in the Republican Party, and so forth. And I don't think it's quite that serious, but it is something that's fairly unusual, where the party does have to take that kind of visible rejection of one of its leadership people.
You do sound a little skeptical when you say, this is a break, or this is a fracturing of the GOP. Why do you think that it might not be as serious as some people are assessing?
Well, you know, I think that there are going to be other members of the House that probably also feel the way Cheney does. The problem with what Cheney did was she was just more vocal about it and decided to sort of publicize her position in ways that then created this impression of greater dissension in the Republican Party. Now, of course, the Republican Party, what they want to do is basically have a unified message, and they're still trying to deal with how to handle Trump. And of course, some members of the House and some members of the Senate too, for that matter, are four square behind Trump and all of this, and sort of basically repeating the things that we saw from last fall and through January. Other members, you know, not so much, or they didn't like the way Trump handled it for one reason or another. And especially some feel, and I've heard that this is Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's position, that he's upset with Trump because basically feels that Trump lost the two Georgia Senate seats that went to Democrats this last time around. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But on the other hand, there's certainly a large number of Republican voters that still do like Trump and still do think that there were problems with the 2020 election. Whether they were as serious as a stolen election is, you know, most people don't believe that, but some people still do. But you don't want to basically get your voting base upset with you when you're coming up on midterm elections. And of course, we're always coming up on elections of one sort or another. But still, you don't want to alienate a group. And Trump certainly has something to do with that. You'd like to see, to the extent that people still like Trump, you'd like to see him out there helping people that are running in various seats, particularly close seats, because the Republicans feel they have a pretty good chance of retaking the House in the 2022 elections.
Yeah, there's no evidence that there was any fraud to the degree that President Trump claimed in the 2020 election. We're talking with Tim Hagel, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party here on Central Time. What do you want to see most from the GOP in the future? How can the party achieve the goals that you hope for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@WPR.org. We've got Annie from Green Bay ready to join the conversation. Hey, Annie.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good, thanks. What are you thinking about when we have this conversation?
Liz Cheney. I am very respectful of her. I admire her a great deal for her moxie and taking a stand, and even though she has to do it all alone, good for her. I am a Democrat. I do not vote Republican, but I have a strong admiration for her, and I do not think it was right what they did to her. And if she ran for president in the future, I like what she did so much that I might even vote for her.
All right, Annie, thank you for helping us understand what your perspective is. And you know, Tim, I hear Annie saying, I think that she did the right thing. And yet what we're seeing in the House is kind of this thing that if you don't support Trump publicly, then you're not going to be in leadership positions. Is that a fair assessment?
I think for the most part it is, but it's not exactly new that we basically see that for Democrats as well and Republicans in the past, that again, the idea behind leadership is you want people that are going to have and present a unified message, whatever that message happens to be. And right now, the Republican message is complicated, of course, by Trump and sort of what your position is on that. And Cheney just wasn't having it. And so she decided to speak out. And you can characterize that if you want to as the right thing to do. Certainly in terms of her Cheney's position, they say this is what she believes, she's going to not back down from telling people about it. Okay. But if you're in a leadership position, the expectation is that you're sort of on message, whatever that message happens to be. So for Cheney to stay in leadership, she would have needed to tone that down a little bit, not change her position necessarily, but not also go out and sort of advertise it in ways that shows that there's some potential dissension among the Republican Party. I can't think of any specific examples, but you know, similar things have undoubtedly happened among Democrats as well. Again, the idea being is that when you're part of party leadership, you need to be part of that team.
Well, and that's exactly what Elise Stefanik of New York, who's taking Cheney's place as the conference chair, it's exactly what that representative has said she'll do, that she'll put aside her individual inclinations and speak for the party.
Yeah, and one interesting aspect of this, and many people pointed this out, is that Liz Cheney, you know, by various measures, is much more conservative than Stefanik, and yet gets replaced by her. Well, you know, Stefanik is basically saying, okay, well, maybe there are some issues that I would disagree with, but I'm now part of the leadership team, and so you kind of tamp those down a little bit. But to whatever extent maybe they became a problem in the future, then maybe she would step down. So again, you if you're part of leadership, that you want to stay on message, and this is just no surprise.
We have James on the line from Milwaukee now. Welcome to Central Time, James.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. I had a little bit of a different perspective. I think that it's Liz Cheney who's lost touch with modern Republicans and not the other way around. I think that the 2016 election and the 2015 primary was a major inflection point for the values of the Republican Party. And I think Cheney and her cohorts like Jeb Bush lost that ideological battle. And this is no more representing a schism between Republicans than Jeb Bush's defeat in 2015 did, because Liz Cheney has staked out only a few policy positions that distinguish her from other Republicans, and they're not very attractive to Republican voters. She loves to invade Middle Eastern countries and extend our current wars. And then she has a real personal animus towards Donald Trump. And those seem to be the only things that distinguish her from other conservatives besides, you know, like you say, she has some conservative positions, but those don't necessarily align with modern Republicans. The social issues that she's more conservative on, they aren't as important anymore. So in short, I just think that she's out of touch with the Republican voter and that there's not much of a schism within the party.
James, thank you so much for that. I want to give Tim Hagel a chance to respond to James saying it's Liz is out of touch.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, that's certainly true. That again, part of the Republican base now, and you may argue whether it actually is part of the base or if the base is splintering, but there's a good chunk of people that were voting Republican, especially in 2016, if not 2020, that were basically of the idea that we like Trump. Sometimes we may not like his personal style, but we like the fact that he fights. And that kind of became a cliche for a lot of people, even people on the right, kind of the never Trumper, saying, oh, well, he fights, that excuses a lot. Well, it kind of does, because one of the things that a lot of Republicans were concerned about for a number of years was that they were electing people who didn't seem to fight hard for whatever it was. Now, I think that a lot of people would argue that, well, maybe Trump fights, but he maybe fought a little bit too hard, or he fought the wrong battle when it came, especially post-election 2020 and what was going on there through January until he was no longer in office. But still, the idea that they want to see, they being the Republican base, want to see somebody that's going to fight hard for their positions. And for somebody like Liz Cheney to minimize that and just all say, oh, well, it's Trumpism and it's not good, that they're not going to like that too much.
We're talking with Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. We're looking at where the Republican Party goes next after the House GOP removed U.S. Representative Liz Cheney from her leadership post after her calls to reject former President Trump. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this move by House Republicans? If you're an independent voter, how are you looking at this? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues on Central Time. Republicans aren't necessarily on the same page when it comes to the future of the GOP. We're talking about what happens next and what Republicans need to do to unify their members. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Tim Hagel is a political scientist at the University of Iowa. And we're talking about former President Trump and the future of the Republican Party. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Do you think this is a good direction for the party to go? Or do you wish Republicans would set their sights on something else, handle themselves differently? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tim, I want to circle back to when you said that there are people visibly who are Republicans, visibly in front of people needing to make sure that they're with the party. And then there are people who might think very differently when thinking about President Trump and his influence over the party. And there are people who are further to the right that still have criticisms of the Republican Party right now.
Oh, sure. Regardless of what party you're talking about, Democrats or Republicans, it's always, well, the phrase often used is a big tent. And basically what that means, regardless of whether you're talking one party or the other, is that you're going to have a range of people in there. There's some people, Republicans, you're going to have more conservatives, some are more moderate, used to be some even liberal Republicans, all, especially in the northeast part of the country for members of Congress, but those kind of have been voted out. For Democrats, you've got some that are very what we call progressive these days, and some that are more in the moderate range, maybe even a few kind of conservatives on certain issues. But for the most part, again, there's that range. And so it's always a matter of trying to accommodate the most number of people, if you're talking members of Congress, excuse me, or even voters for that matter.
Hmm. Yeah. And I want to take Steve from Sun Prairie now. We've got Steve who wants to join our conversation. Want to hear what Steve thinks. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think if you have to look at it through a prism of what Cheney is trying to do politically, you know, I think that most politicians, probably all politicians, they care about themselves first, the party second, and maybe, and I say that lightly, maybe country third. And so I do think he's trying to set herself apart from Trump in order to run kind of how John Kasich ran in 2016 and try to basically establish that wing of the Republican Party. So I think it's just political calculations on her part.
Steve, thanks for that. And Steve brings up this idea of, you know, really a third party. And there are people who are more moderate in the Republican Party, either floating the idea of starting another party or saying, you know, gosh, the idea is that it's really hard to win if you're outside the party. We have to affect change from the inside. What's your analysis of that, Tim?
Yeah, it's now apparently Cheney was asked directly, and I can't remember who asked her the question, but I saw the clip of her saying that she has no intention of leaving the Republican Party. But certainly other Republicans have said so, and they've talked about this of third party. And usually that kind of talk, whether it's, again, third party having a bunch of Republicans peel off or Democrats peel off, that it's usually going to be just a spoiler. And we saw this in previous elections, if you want to go back, you know, 100 years or so, for the Bull Moose Party and Teddy Roosevelt splitting off of the Republicans that basically threw the election to Woodrow Wilson. Or more recently with Ross Perot in the 92 election and again in 96. So when that happens, it usually hurts one party more than another. On the other hand, if Cheney wants to stay in the party, and as the last caller was saying, and this is a little, I suppose, on the cynical excuse me, I'm choking up here, a little on the cynical side that, you know, she's looking out for herself. And some people have suggested, well, maybe she wants to run for president. Well, I just can't see that in part because it's very, very difficult to run as a member of the House as opposed to a senator where you're much more visible, or a governor of a state. But again, a small state that Wyoming is, I don't know that she'd have much of a chance. I don't know that she's going to be necessarily challenged that much in Wyoming. So in that sense, I don't know that it's that much of a political calculation within state, unless she's planning on running for the Senate or something, or governor or something of that nature. But still, if she's trying to carve out a more conservative set of the party voters, I think that's going to be a hard sell, that she'd be better off with a more sort of moderate liberal folks, because they tend to be the ones that rejected Trump a little bit more. And I don't know that that's going to fly necessarily in Wyoming.
We're talking about the future of the Republican Party here on Central Time with Tim Hagel. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. And Tim, Donald Trump lost the election, but the messaging on that, what Republicans are willing to say and not say, is what we're arguing over here when it comes to Cheney's leadership position that she lost. Is it unusual for a party to publicly stay this close to a candidate who lost?
You know, it depends a little bit. When you think back to Carter, when he lost, that there were great concerns. And it wasn't so much a personal thing with Carter. Obviously, everybody sort of thought he was a very good guy. And, that's the impression that we have even through today. But in terms of his policies, it was a bad time for him. We had inflation and high unemployment and the misery index. And you know, he inherited some of that from the prior administration. Ford was trying to whip inflation now, was the little buttons that he had at the time. And it just wasn't going anywhere for him. It wasn't going anywhere for Carter. And so you even had Teddy Kennedy challenging Carter for the nomination in a fairly serious way. So they kind of rejected Carter. With George H.W. Bush, he only won term and lost, and people still liked him, good guy kind of a thing. But again, unusual circumstances. You had the third party challenge from Ross Perot, and the economy hadn't recovered sufficiently, so Clinton was able to win. With Trump, of course, it's a much more personal level, and Trump fought harder in ways that really a lot of people did not like, that they thought it basically was undercutting his ability to make those arguments. And as I said, even some believe that that's what cost the Republicans control of the Senate when they lost the two Georgia races. So there's sort of that additional kind of a thing. But on the other hand, Trump has a very big voice, even though he's been kicked off social media. And as a result of that, if you alienate Trump, you may alienate a whole lot of voters. And again, Republicans don't want to do that. So they have to kind of watch or march a fine line here, walk a fine line, to try to maybe not necessarily fully embrace some of the things Trump was saying, but not reject him totally so as to not alienate those voters. And we'll have to see what happens after the 2022 elections. If the Republicans win, if Trump has helped a lot, maybe that will help a little bit. if Republicans don't win and maybe Trump was seen as a hindrance, then maybe they'll have more calls to reject him outright. Or if nothing else, just to say, okay, it's time to move on. And of course, one of the big interesting questions is what's Trump going to do in 2024? It's certainly going to cause, I think, some consternation on the part of some Republicans, at least, if he decides to try to run again.
What's going to determine whether Republicans, especially in the House, keep making this loyalty to former President Trump a must for prominent members, or if they loosen up on that issue?
I think time will tell. You know, basically, it's right now it's still pretty fresh in terms of what was going on. We're only a couple of months past, especially the inauguration and the events that happened before it in January. And that's still something that gets talked about a lot. But I think that it's not necessarily a loyalty thing as it is that you can take maybe a neutral position or just how you message it or how you phrase whatever you're going to do. If you just kind of come out and say, yeah, Trump was terrible for Republicans and I reject that, that's not going to get you anywhere, especially in a leadership position. Probably not among voters either, depending on what your district is, if you're talking members of Congress. But I think that you can handle that in a better way to say, all right, you know, there were good things that Trump did in terms of Republican policies, even if you didn't like some of the things that he did in a personal level. But now it's time to, you know, move forward. And here's our message. And that's certainly one of the things that the Republican leadership is going to want to do is to come up with whatever message they have in terms of the 2022 elections, things like the economy and what's going on with health care and some of the other things, the policies, of course, that the Biden administration is working on in terms of, say, the border crisis, for example, among other things.
Do you think Republicans in Congress are more unified around former President Trump than actual Republican voters are? And we just have a moment left.
I think the short answer is no, that there's probably a range among them as well. They're just a little bit better at message discipline.
All right. Tim, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He joined us to talk about where the Republican Party goes next after House members removed U.S. Representative Liz Cheney as conference chair after her critiques of former President Trump. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about how low taxes and minimal regulation have come to be what many think of as a good business climate. And we'll look at research that says those factors may be less important to businesses today than they were in the past. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up on the morning show, early in the pandemic, the State Department of Motor Vehicles made the road test for young driver's license applicants optional. After a year, the agency wants to make that choice to waive the test permanent. An administrator tells us why tomorrow on the morning show. It airs from 6 until 9 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for years, a good business climate has come to be defined by a few simple things: low taxes, minimal regulation, less unionization. Here's former Governor Scott Walker making the case for a plan to cut taxes as a 2014 event with Wisconsin's largest business lobbying group.
If you want to keep the economic recovery going, if you want to keep the ball rolling forward, if you want to put more people to work and enhance the economy and create more opportunity in the state, if you want to make people better in Wisconsin, the best way to do that, to truly stimulate the economy, isn't to keep more money in Madison. It's to put it in the hands of the hardworking taxpayers, the consumers and employers of the state.
Our next guest says there are few things businesses today care about more than taxes, like having access to a pool of highly skilled workers. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Join our conversation. As an employee, what sorts of things do you look for when you're deciding where to live and work? Have you ever not taken a job because you didn't like where it was based? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Steve Deller is a regional economist and a professor in UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. He's the author of a recent report looking at the changing definition of a good business climate. Steve, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Help us understand how we've traditionally thought of what constitutes a good business climate.
His perspective, it goes back 50, 60, even 70 ago. What businesses were looking for was essentially...
Hey, Steve, I'm going to go ahead and jump in here, and we'll see if we can get the connection better. But you're breaking up to the point that we can't quite understand you. So we'll make this better in just a moment. We're talking with Steve Deller, who's a regional economist, and he's written this recent report looking at the changing definition of a good business climate. So we'll talk about what we've traditionally thought of and what the evidence that Steve Deller has shown is changing when it comes to what we're thinking about. You are part of this conversation. So there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Maybe you're a business owner. What sorts of things do you need for your business to thrive? What challenges have you run into doing business that you wish you could change? Are those traditional ideas of low taxes and less regulation what really sets your business up for success? Or do you think that higher regulations might actually help? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Steve, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can. Sorry about that.
Oh, great. No worries. It's easy to switch, and technology is always, up in the air for us. So let me ask you again, what have we traditionally thought of as good business climate?
If we're thinking about the economy 50 years ago, 60 years ago, then things like lower taxes, lower rates of unionization, fewer environmental regulations seem to make sense. The thing is that the economy has fundamentally changed over the past 50 years, and what businesses are looking for now has really changed. Access to skilled labor, access to quality of life, access to things that make the business owners life more pleasant, like good schools to send your kids to. So it's really kind of we need to rethink what a business climate means today, given today's economy, not the economy of 50 years ago.
And you say not the economy of 50 years ago, but really this idea of the what a successful business climate needs extends decades before that.
Oh, it does. You can trace it back to the Mississippi Balancing Agriculture and Industry Act of 1933. They kind of laid the gambit down in terms of they were trying to recruit manufacturing firms from the northern states to move down to Mississippi. And their selling point was cheap labor, cheap taxes, no regulations, and no unions. And that was kind of they laid the gauntlet down. And a lot of states felt as though they needed to respond, and they responded relative to what old school manufacturers were looking for. That was, back in the Great Depression, the economy's fundamentally changed. So what was relevant 50, 60, 70 years ago isn't really relevant today.
So what are some of the ways you've seen public policy in Wisconsin shaped around this traditional view of what we need for successful economies?
I think that there's been a fundamental change with the change of administration in the governor's office. Under the Walker administration, it was very old school. It was that, again, economy of 50 years ago. But under the new administration, there's been a shift towards less so of a focus on the legacy industries in Wisconsin. They're not being ignored, but less of a focus on the legacy industries and more of a focus on business startups and entrepreneurship. There is a tremendous amount of research that has pretty much, it's not a question, it's pretty much a proven fact, as much as you can have a fact in economics, that the engine of economic growth is not really existing businesses, it's new business formation. So with the new administration, there's been a shift in the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation a little bit more towards we need to focus on business startups. Now, this is where it comes in to, what are the preferences of the person that's starting the business? A lot of times people make a decision, where do they want to live, and that's where they start their business. That's a very fundamentally different perspective of simply cutting taxes for the sake of cutting taxes.
And you say that things have shifted some, but I think the easiest example for us to grasp onto is Foxconn. I mean, this gubernatorial administration is still working with Foxconn, and Foxconn really, the deal was brokered under the Walker administration, and Foxconn had a lot of incentives, tax-wise, money-wise, to come to Wisconsin. And your argument in this is that that doesn't really work.
It doesn't work. Foxconn did not work. Foxconn is a shadow of what they proposed they were going to do. That, again, is kind of old school thinking. What we need to be focusing on less is trying to recruit businesses to Wisconsin. Businesses just don't pick up and move that much. The research is pretty clear that the engine of growth is entrepreneurship. Why would people want to start a business in Wisconsin? We don't really see a lot of businesses moving around. Those that do move tend to be pretty small, and they move less than 10 miles. So a lot of times what we see when we, you know, we trace this throughout the 2000s and up into about 2015, we traced firm movement in Wisconsin, and less than 3% of firms move in a given year. And those that do move tend to have less than 10 employees, and what they're doing is they're moving across town. So this idea of trying to recruit manufacturing firms or big businesses like a Foxconn is really a misuse of the limited resources that we have. What we should be focusing on, rather, is creating an entrepreneurial ecosystem, if you will. Why would people want to start businesses in Wisconsin, and what can we do to help them get started? When we think about it that way, the notion of a business climate really kind of fundamentally shifts. We start thinking about quality of life. We start thinking of access to finance. We start thinking about access to quality labor. And tax rates really don't matter. Businesses will tell you that taxes do matter, but when you watch what they actually do, taxes don't matter that much.
We have Emmanuel in Kenosha on the line at 800-642-1234. Welcome to Central Time, Emmanuel.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in the trucking business. I'm an independent trucker. And so I kind of live and work wherever I want. And so I was hoping to get feedback from your guest on a couple of other issues that I see as hugely problematic in this business, including in Wisconsin. The first being that I don't believe that less regulation or fewer taxes are necessarily a good thing in this business, but perhaps what your guests could comment on is the fact that there's very little enforcement of the rules. So those of us who are small and try to play by the rules constantly find ourselves shouting in the wind, so to speak, because those who cheat, the government doesn't have the resources, state police forces particularly don't have the resources to be out here enforcing the most basic of laws, like speeding. You know, I don't speed, so the guy who speeds is literally cheating me out of money every mile.
Emmanuel, I want to jump in here because I want Steve to be able to comment on your situation, because what I hear in Emmanuel's comment there is that small businesses or independent workers, they struggle against a system.
I think there's an excellent point there. Regulations in and of themselves are not necessarily bad. Actually, regulations can help because it removes a certain amount of uncertainty. It's essentially establishing the rules of the game. So when the regulations are there, right, it kind of helps the independents like Emmanuel to essentially say, what can I do or what can't I do? Okay. Now, what drives businesses nuts is when the regulations are arbitrarily changed or they're arbitrarily enforced. Okay, that doesn't mean that, you know, sometimes we get the regulations wrong. I mean, you know, people develop these regulations and people make mistakes. So we need to constantly be going in and refining the rules of the game, if you will. But when those rules are arbitrarily changed or they're arbitrarily enforced, that drives businesses nuts. One of the things, Madison, for example, has had a reputation of having a poor business climate. And the reason for that is that the city council is constantly changing their mind. So they've put in a set of regulations, and then the following year, we changed our mind, and they changed the regulations. Those types of things drive businesses nuts. Or they see that my competitor, my neighbor here, who's in the same business as I am, they're getting away with not following the rules. The rules are not being enforced consistently. So there are certain elements around regulations that we need to do a better job of.
Hmm. Emmanuel,
simply cutting them to cut them is not a good idea.
Thanks for that, Steve. We're talking with Steve Deller. He is a professor in the UW-Madison's Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics. And we're talking about what makes a good business climate. And wanted to say thank you to our caller, Emmanuel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think a good business climate means? What do you think Wisconsin should have to support economies? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This conversation continues. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time. We are talking about the shifting definition of a good business climate here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Economist Steve Deller is with us for the conversation, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are there amenities like good schools or being close to nature that are requirements for a place you would be willing to live and work? Or are there some you would compromise on to take a job in a new place? Maybe you're a small business owner or a large business owner. What do you need for your business to be successful? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steve, in 2019, Amazon pulled out of plans to locate some of its operations in New York. That was after public pushback that was in part about labor unions not wanting the company to fight efforts to unionize there. Does that show us that some of those traditional factors in a business climate actually do matter?
You know, actually, the research does seem to suggest that companies will tend to avoid states with high rates of unionization. That the research is suggesting that. But if you get a little bit deeper, it's a little bit more subtle than simply unions are bad. It depends on the relationship between the union and management. For example, when Volkswagen had their assembly plant in Tennessee voting to go union, the company actually wanted the workforce to go union because the German tradition is that the union and management are kind of part of a team. Union, the labor kind of realizes that, hey, as the company goes, we go. So they work together. Now, if unions are able to play that role and essentially say we are part of the management team and working together, unions can actually be a positive. Now, if unions are, on the other hand, are militant and are very confrontational with the company, then that can be bad. An example of that is the relationship of the labor union with Caterpillar in central Illinois. That was a very confrontational relationship, and that really tarnished the state of Illinois from a manufacturer's perspective. So it depends. It's not just having a union by itself is not necessarily bad. It's how does that union work with the company? If they're partners, it can be a positive thing. If they're adversaries, then yes, it is true. Unions can be bad.
We've got Owen in Wauwega who wants to join this conversation. Hey, Owen.
Hello.
Hi there. What's on your mind?
Hi, Keeley. Hey, I've got a couple points here. My first point is this, you know, as a young person, a young entrepreneur, just trying to access a labor force that has the ability to purchase an affordable home and pay a mortgage is really tough in Wisconsin, especially closer to metropolitan areas. And even in the rural areas, there's just so much land that's not available for smaller first-time homeowners to purchase and afford to pay a mortgage that would be within their means. That makes it really tough for a new business to feel comfortable coming to Wisconsin because they know that a motivated labor force is going to be the labor force that has a few things that they're really concerned about, and one of them is paying a mortgage, the second would be a family. And the third thing that I wanted to focus on was young entrepreneurs or beginning business entrepreneurs. We have a lot of things that are stacked against us right now because we've subsidized so many of the larger corporations in such a macro scale that the small independent businesses have really not been able to compete against the large corporate structures that exist here in the state that have been given massive amounts of Paycheck Protection Loan and other small business loan contributions this last year and a half. And I watched my business suffer as a result of that. Even though my Google reviews are 5-star, the competitors that I have been able to outdo me in advertising and able to purchase land and facilities because they had been given a lot of money through the federal government.
Oh, and thank you so much for sharing what you've experienced with your business. And Steve, let's take that last point about large businesses getting large subsidies. What do you hear?
I think that that's partially true, and that's part of the old school thought of business, what's a positive business climate. Basically, what's good for General Motors is good for America. There's still a lot of that mindset. The other thing, too, is that there's a lot of programs that are available to small businesses. The problem, though, is getting access to those programs. Sometimes larger firms have the staff to be able to go in and take advantage of those programs, whereas your smaller business owners don't have the expertise, if you will, to be able to go in and get that. And I think that's something the WDC is working on very seriously, is trying to address that disconnect. And I think that's important. Now, one thing that was brought up was housing. This is something that Wisconsin is really struggling with, is housing. And it, a lot of communities got to the housing issue kind of through a labor shortage. They were kind of saying, and this is all pre-COVID, is that we've got these jobs. Why aren't people moving to the community to take these jobs? And they got the housing as the issue. Housing was the bottleneck. But as communities started thinking about it, they kind of started thinking and shifting and saying, well, what can we do to make our community more attractive so that people would want to live here? And they've kind of shifted away from focusing solely on businesses and kind of thinking about what's called placemaking. How can we make this a better place for people to live? And once they move here, start their businesses here. So it's a complete kind of shifting of how we think about fostering economic development.
Brandy wrote on the Ideas Network Facebook page, she says there are plenty of businesses hiring right now, but their pay stinks and their benefits stink. The whole get a better job doesn't work when there aren't better jobs. What do you have to say to Brandy?
That is true. Looking at the labor shortage, right? There are several things that are driving the labor shortage, okay? And we're talking about it now. What we're doing is we're kind of getting back to where we were before COVID. We're still facing the same labor shortage issues, and it's multifaceted. But one of them simply is pay scale. People used to think that something like a $15 an hour job was a pretty good paying job. Not in reality. As a lot of communities have worried about their housing situation, they're starting to realize that a $15 an hour job, even a $20 an hour job, given the housing market, is not a very good job. So it's really getting folks rethinking what we mean by economic development.
And as we look forward, we just have about a minute left, and I'm wondering where you think we can go to kind of match public policy with these ideas of what we really need in a business climate. Where do we start?
I think that the real kind of long-term impact is at the local level, because these are kind of, you know, we're making investments today that may not have a payoff for 5-10 years, okay? But those payoffs will be very sustainable and very impactful. What the state can do is really, how can they better facilitate that? How can they be a better partner for these local efforts?
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things that the new administration is trying to do, is how can the state be a better partner rather than simply saying we're the only game in town and it's basically our way.
Stephen Deller, a regional economist and professor at UW-Madison. You heard him here on Central Time. Coming. We'll be right back. I guess you can call it sweet revenge. Around midnight on April 19th, a man got the lock open at a Milwaukee bakery and made off with the cash drawer. A security camera caught an image of the suspect, and the bakery owners figured they could improve upon the wanted poster in the form of sugar cookies. Canfora Bakery printed the image of the man from the security footage on edible paper, and then they put those pictures on sugar cookies. There he is in sort of fuzzy night vision screenshot, surrounded by a ring of piped buttercream frosting and red sanding sugar. So the bakery made 8 dozen of these suspect sugar cookies, and then they gave them away earlier this month, figuring maybe the community can help us identify the person who took the cash. And last week, Milwaukee police announced they'd arrested a 45-year-old man in the burglary, but they're not crediting the cookies with helping them catch the suspect. I feel like this is the place where I'm supposed to make a bunch of cookie puns, but I don't think that would bake this story any better. No? Yeah, that didn't land. We won't try that again. You have my word. This is Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network.